Okay, today I'm going to be talking about the 1961-62 period, which it's a very, very interesting phase in the whole history of the Cold War. This is when the Cold War kind of comes to a head, and we'll see in the lecture next time how a relatively stable international system emerges from this period of crisis, right? So the story is of considerable interest in its own terms. It's just as pure history. But I want to remind you that our goal in this class is not just to review the history as an end in itself, but to use the historical analysis as a vehicle for getting at some of the basic issues that international relations theorists are interested in. Above all, the kind of core question that defines this whole field of inquiry, the whole problem of war and peace, you know. How is international conflict to be understood, you know? And why is it that sometimes a relatively stable international system takes shape? Problem of conflict and also the problem of stability. And one of the key insights that you get from grappling with these problems on a fairly abstract level is the idea that conflict and cooperation, they're like two sides to a coin. There's a sense almost in which conflict is self-limiting. Why? Because as conflicts sharpen, they draw out what the real policy of a country is, right? As the risk of war, or at least the perceived risk of war, increases, countries that are simply engaging in bluff and bluster, they fall by the wayside. They're not willing to, carry that policy of bluff too far. The fear of war causes them to kind of back off, right? Whereas countries that really care about an issue, they're going to dig in their heels, right? So one of the functions of international conflict in general, and of crisis in particular, is that it draws out what the real policies of countries are. And when countries, when both sides in a conflict reveal their true preferences, when they reveal what their real policies are, well, then there's much greater chance that they could reach an understanding, right? So that's a basic line of thought that plays a very, very important role in contemporary international relations theory. The kind of fundamental ideas here were laid out in a book called The Causes of War by this Australian historian named Geoffrey Blainey. And Blainey's argument in that book was, why do you have war? You have war when countries disagree about what the structure of power is. At least one of the two sides thinks that it's stronger than it actually is. This is a kind of problem of false optimism is the central taproot of war. Because if both sides had a correct understanding of what the balance of power was, they would be able to adjust their policies accordingly, and the policies of both sides would then be in harmony with the fundamental structure of power, and therefore be in harmony with each other. Right? So if both sides understood power realities, they'd be able to strike a deal. right? The weaker side would draw in its horns, would accommodate to the power of the stronger side. The stronger side would have an accurate understanding of how far it could go, and so on. So the notion is that war results from a kind of information problem. Why does that information problem even exist? It's because countries have a built-in incentive to make it seem that they're actually more resolute, that they're tougher, that they're stronger, that they're more willing to kind of push things than they actually are. They have what's called an incentive to misrepresent, right? But a crisis kind of clears away that incentive to represent. Blaney's basic insight was taken up by a number of international relations scholars, the most prominent of whom is James Fearon, who in the mid-1990s published a very important article called Rationalist Explanations for War, basically laying out this kind of argument. And it's a very powerful argument. And one of the things that we're doing when we're looking at the Cold War is we can see that there's something very powerful to that insight, that the Cold War conflict, especially when it reaches crisis proportions as it did during the Berlin crisis period, has the same effect that Blaney said war had. According to Blaney, what cleared up these misconceptions was the actual outbreak of war. War revealed what the true balance of power was. You could see how strong each side was. And when those things became clear in a post-war period, then you had a period of stability until these misconceptions began to build up again. Well, crisis plays the same role that war plays. It reveals something fundamental about how tough each side is, right? And it helps the two sides reach some sort of settlement. At least that's the concept, right? And we can see this whole dynamic at work when we look at the whole Berlin crisis period. The period from the beginning of the crisis with Khrushchev's ultimatum of November of 1958, that I talked about last time, is when the crisis begins, until after all these different phases, various ups and downs and so on, it reaches its climax in the Cuban Missile Crisis. An important point, by the way, about the Cuban Missile Crisis. People think of, the Cuban Missile Crisis, it just kind of happened out of nowhere. It was like this summer thunderstorm that just kind of comes on the scene, runs its course, and then kind of goes away. But one of the big insights that you get by studying the history of international politics is that's not the way events are to be understood. They're part and parcel of a historical process. They're embedded in a historical process. Cuban Missile Crisis didn't just happen out of nowhere. It was the climax of this great crisis that had been building up in Europe, focused on Berlin, a crisis which really was about Germany, right? About Germany. That's the fundamental insight that you get by looking at the whole story of the Cold War in its very dramatic phase, which is the phase from 1946 when it began until late 62, early 63 when it was resolved. The German question was the central taproot of the Cold War. Why do we know that? Because there's this basic understanding, basic structure of the system. The two sides can get along by not challenging each other's preeminence in its part of Europe. Right? There's one great exception to that rule that has to do with West Germany. The Soviets cannot afford to give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they want in West Germany. If their policy is such as to lead to a full resurgence of West German power, let's just say full sovereignty for West Germany, including the ability to build up military power, including nuclear power, to whatever level the Germans are physically capable of, well, that's something the Soviets would find intolerable. It's something that they would conceivably be willing to risk war over. And certainly to pursue a policy of escalating the level of tension short of war. Okay? German question has to be central. And so then the question of war and peace turns down to the, you know, boils down to the whole question of, can the two sides reach an agreement about Germany? Where the Soviets are prevented from taking over West Germany, to be sure, West Germany is still part of the Western Bloc, but West Germany would pose no threat to the Soviets. In particular, West Germany would not be allowed to develop a nuclear capability under her own control. Couldn't they reach such an agreement? Well, you'd think that they had. You look at what was agreed to in the Paris Accords in October of 1954. That's what the Paris Accords provided for. West Germany had promised not to build nuclear weapons on her own territory. That promise was built into the whole structure of the Paris Accords in a variety of different ways. Instead, West Germany would be provided with security by being integrated into the NATO system more generally, a system based on American power. Any possible German threat would be contained within a system dominated by American power, right? But it doesn't work. The proof that it doesn't work is you have the Soviets laying on this Berlin crisis just a few years later, 4 years later. Why do they do it? Just out of sheer aggressiveness? That's not the way international politics works. We've seen that over and over again this course. The policy of the Soviet Union was based on perfectly understandable and indeed defensive political calculations. Their concerns about German power made a lot of sense from their point of view. Whereas a weak Germany would be dependent on the Western powers for protection, those powers were perfectly happy to live with the status quo of a divided Germany, and thus Germany was locked into a purely defensive policy. Soviets could live with that. But if West Germany became strong and in position to challenge the status quo, and a strong West Germany would encourage the people in communist East Germany to rise up against their communist overlords, and West Germany might intervene, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this is a nightmare for the Soviets. They would want to nip it in the bud, prevent anything of that sort from happening. You know, for them, it seemed there was a good chance that the nuclearization of West Germany would be a fighting issue. Okay? They try and head this off in the mid-1950s with their plans for a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. You know, no dice as far as the Western powers are concerned. And so finally, with the West moving ahead with this policy of nuclearizing West Germany, the Soviets felt the time for action had come. They have this one obvious lever. It's West Berlin. You know, under the military protection of the three Western powers, in the middle of communist East Germany, very easy to cut off access to West Berlin. They had done it before in 48-49, right? So they threatened now to do it again. Okay. So you have the Soviets making this This threat now over West Berlin. Why are they making this threat? Because the West is proceeding with this policy of building up German power, despite the Paris Accords. Why are the Western powers doing that? Because Eisenhower has a certain concept of how things should be structured, of what America's relationship to Europe should be, of how the European countries should be treated, what their role in the international system should be. Eisenhower's basic feeling is these people are inherently strong enough to defend themselves. They have the population, they have the economic resources. You know, the one thing that's really needed is that they come together in some sort of political unit. But, you know, while that's happening, let them kind of work together within the NATO framework. Let the NATO framework become essentially a European security structure. Let Europe become a third great power mass in world affairs. Because when that happens, America can pull out. We're not cut out for the imperial role, according to Eisenhower, right? The Europeans can and therefore should defend themselves. They should take responsibility for their own political destiny. They shouldn't be totally, you know, emasculated, totally dependent on the United States. And we shouldn't have to bear the burden of the defense of Western Europe forever. Right? That's a basic concept. It's underscored by these other considerations having to do with military realities. You know, the MC-48 strategy implies that the Europeans should be armed with nuclear weapons. The prospect of looming strategic parity, where if the United States escalated to the level of general nuclear war, the Soviets would retaliate with whatever they had left and go on to destroy American society. All these things point in the same direction. The Europeans, in general, the Germans in particular, should be armed with nuclear forces. How could you say that they shouldn't have what the Soviets have? How could you say these people shouldn't be allowed to defend themselves? You know, it would just be poison in the alliance. They obviously wanted to defend themselves, not for aggressive reasons. Adenauer was no great believer in German unification, but, you know, If you're looking at this thing through the eyes of the Europeans, why should you think that America would forever be willing to commit suicide in order to protect your fundamental interests? You know, would America really opt for nuclear escalation in the event that West Germany was attacked? If that meant the end of American society, well, maybe not. Probably not. In the long run, probably not. In which case, the Europeans should have nuclear capability of their own. Once they had that, then their security would be, you know, established. All right. You have this Eisenhower strategy. This is why the 1954 arrangements, the Paris Accord system, doesn't work. Right? Paris Accord system was based on limiting German power. The Eisenhower strategy implied the nuclearization of West Germany. And not just implied it in some sort of theoretical sense. In practice, that's what the Americans are doing. In practice, they're giving the Europeans de facto control over American nuclear weapons. They can't do it overtly because it's against the law. So they make an end run around the Atomic Energy Act. You know, they have this policy that skirts the edge of legality because it's like so important to make sure that the Europeans are able to defend themselves. It's like very, very basic for Eisenhower. Soviets object to this. That's the meaning of the Berlin crisis when they lay it on in November of 1958. But they're unwilling to push things too far when it becomes clear to them that while the Americans are by no means totally intransigent and are willing to make certain concessions to the Soviets, above all in terms of the de facto recognition of the East German state, on this kind of core issue of will West Germany have nuclear weapons, Americans aren't going to give way, and the Germans aren't going to give way. So instead of escalating when this becomes clear, they put the crisis on hold. I mean, in a sense, what choice do they have? The Americans still have a strategic superiority, right? If war breaks out and we struck hard enough and fast enough, if we struck first, once we became convinced that war was unavoidable, then the Soviets would, Soviet power would be largely neutralized. Whatever they were able to do with the forces they had left after an American first strike would not be enough to cause really heavy damage to American society. There might be some, but America would survive. And in such circumstances, Eisenhower and Dulles felt it was very, very unlikely that the Soviets would escalate. Okay? But they're prepared to kind of move ahead. You know, if American will is tested, yes, we're willing to use nuclear weapons against them massively. That's the Eisenhower policy. Given that policy, the Soviets put the whole Berlin business on hold. Everyone thought that after the collapse of the Paris summit in May of 1960, the failure to reach a negotiated settlement, the Soviets would then, you know, escalate the level of tension. Didn't happen. Didn't happen for the rest of the Eisenhower. Because these people are sensitive to military realities, to political realities. The fundamental nature of the Eisenhower policy had been made manifest. In November of 1960, John F. Kennedy is elected President of the United States. Takes office in January of 1961. And surprise, surprise, the Soviets try again. And this time, it seems like there's another real chance of reaching some sort of settlement, because American policy toward Europe is transformed dramatically under Kennedy. How's it transformed? You look at the textbooks and say, oh, well, there was this fundamental change between Eisenhower and Kennedy. Eisenhower had this nuclear strategy of massive retaliation. But under Kennedy, the strategy changed to something that was called flexible response. In other words, under Eisenhower, as soon as, you know, the other side really challenged our fundamental interests, you know, it would be, you know, the GO code would go up, the basic war plan, it was called the PSIOP, S-I-O-P, Single Integrated Operational Plan, this massive all-out attack. The PSIOP would be executed, and pretty soon, in words of one of the famous documents from this period, the Soviet Union would be a smoking, radiating ruin. Right? That was supposedly the Eisenhower strategy, a tripwire strategy. They move against Berlin, boom, it's World War III, you know, total thermonuclear holocaust. Under Kennedy, however, and this is the standard line that you find in all these textbooks, they moved away from such a heavy reliance on nuclear escalation. They wanted to kind of really draw out the conventional phase of the fighting. They wanted to build up their conventional forces so that the president wouldn't be forced to choose between thermonuclear holocaust or surrender. They wanted a third option. That's the standard view. It turns out that view is essentially incorrect. Certainly it's a gross distortion of the difference between the Kennedy and the Eisenhower military strategy. Under Eisenhower, if Berlin were cut off, the plan was to start with low-level probes, you know, and gradually escalate the level of military operations if those probes were blocked by the East Germans of the Soviets, to escalate the level of military operations up to the level of a full reinforced division, which is a major force, right, serious force. And if the Soviets fired on that division, then in the terms of one of these documents, the fat would be in the fire, and then it would be total nuclear escalation, World War III, execute the PSIOP, all the bombs would go off. Right? How did the Kennedy policy differ from that? If Berlin were cut off, we would also have a policy of gradual escalation, conventional fighting, you know, probes up to the level, not of a single division, but to the level of three divisions. In other words, a full army corps. You know, it's a little bit further, a little bit more longer phase of conventional escalation before he went nuclear. But if that didn't work and those forces were fired upon, then the notion was that the president, whether he wanted to or not, would be under enormous pressure to use nuclear weapons. And once any of them were used, you might as well, you know, destroy the other side's ability to use his nuclear weapons against you by attacking the other side's nuclear forces in the Soviet homeland. In other words, again, World War III. This was not a plan for limited, discriminated, controlled, protracted general nuclear war. Once the decision was made to go nuclear, it would essentially be the same as it had been under Eisenhower, namely full nuclear escalation. Right. So the rhetoric suggested a far more dramatic transformation of U.S. military strategy than actually occurred. Right. And I'm going to be talking about why the Kennedy people adopted that sort of rhetoric, the flexible response rhetoric, the whole idea that a nuclear war could be fought in a discriminate, controlled way where you avoid causing damage to the enemy's civilian populations, you just attack his nuclear forces and so on. How do we know that that was not the real strategy? Because the war plans didn't change. The capability of fighting a protracted nuclear war, you would need to create survivable command and control facilities to control the nuclear forces in a nuclear environment. Yeah, it wasn't done. The war plans didn't provide for, you know, discriminate nuclear attacks. Okay, the rhetoric didn't correspond to the real military policy. It was concocted, as I'll explain in a minute, for political reasons. All right. So that's not the way policy was transformed from Eisenhower to Kennedy. This whole notion Eisenhower had massive retaliation, Kennedy had flexible response, doesn't really capture what was going on there. But there was a transformation of absolutely fundamental importance. The Kennedy concept was radically different from the Eisenhower concept. Not in the area of general nuclear strategy, but in the area of NATO policy, of America's relations with the European allies, of the vision, the long-term vision of America's role in the world, America's role in Europe. Right? In a sense, Eisenhower, the Republican, he's kind of like the idealist. The Europeans should get together and form a United States of Europe, and they should be able to defend themselves, whereas America should kind of pull out of Europe, and you know, we're not cut out for the imperial role. And so on. Under Kennedy, the notion was that's just pie in the sky. The Kennedy people are far more pragmatic than under Eisenhower. It's just pie in the sky. It's not going to happen. The Europeans aren't going to get together in the United States of Europe. You know, they're never going to be able to defend themselves. And we don't want them to, really, because we don't want the Germans to get their finger on the nuclear trigger. We don't want the Germans to have a nuclear capability. We don't trust them. We don't want to underwrite the sort of policy the Germans would be able to engage in once they became strong. We wanted limited German power. But our goal was now to block a German nuclear force. Right. And if you're going to block a German nuclear force, what did that imply about NATO as a whole? Well, you had to turn against the idea of helping the French develop their nuclear force. Eisenhower was kind of in favor of that. Say, well, because you know, you couldn't say no to the Germans and then say yes to the French, and then you couldn't, and you couldn't say yes, and it also implied that the United States would have to now, you know, pull back from its policy of helping the British with their nuclear program, because if you're saying no to the French, you couldn't say yes to the British. Yeah.
Why did we have to say no?
Because if we said yes to the French and no to the Germans, then the Germans would be singled out. You're unworthy. We don't trust you. In too blatant a way, right? I mean, it's true. They weren't opposed to the French force. Kennedy wasn't opposed to the French force as a matter of principle. It was only because of the implications vis-a-vis Germany. Same thing about the British. If the Germans weren't to be singled out and held up as the one major NATO ally that can't be allowed to have nuclear forces because you couldn't trust them, well, what's that going to do to our relations with Germany, the future of the alliance, right? So you had to blur the distinctions and make it seem like, it's not that we're discriminating against Germany. We just think it's very bad for other countries to develop nuclear forces of their own because nuclear proliferation is this terrible thing. By the way, this whole term, proliferation, it was unknown during the Eisenhower period. The whole word proliferation has a very negative connotation. It's a loaded term. Proliferation, is the term itself suggests, you know, the acquisition of nuclear capabilities by new countries is inherently bad. Under Eisenhower, they didn't talk about this. They had the term nuclear sharing, that suggests generosity. That says, you know, being helpful to your friends, to your allies. You know, allowing the NATO allies to develop nuclear capabilities. This is inherently good. You see, so there's this transformation that's reflected in the terminology. Incidentally, if you follow these things, there was even a period around 1960 when these ideas were in transition. When they actually used neutral language, there were terms like spread of nuclear weapons, nuclear diffusion, and so on. But that changed. Now this whole non-proliferation ideology is adopted, not because in their hearts Kennedy and his top advisors thought it would be a bad thing for Britain and France to have nuclear capabilities. They were worried. It was all Germany-specific. They were worried about the effect vis-a-vis Germany. Okay? But if Germany is going to be kept non-nuclear, what does that mean about America's role in Europe? Someone's going to have to protect West Germany. British and French couldn't do it. There's not going to be some sort of European super state in which the Germans are embedded that can do it. See? It's going to be Uncle Sam. The Americans are going to have to remain present in Europe because we can't allow the Soviets to take over, you know, all these resources in West Germany. It would have a dramatic effect on the world balance of power. You know, that was obviously out of the question. So the Europeans couldn't defend themselves. The Americans were going to have to do it. So we were stuck in Europe. Why were we stuck in Europe? Because there's no purely European solution to the European security problem. That's the basic insight. But if we're stuck in Europe, and American forces are going to have to remain in Europe, and that would be true even after America had lost its nuclear edge, when the prospect of American nuclear escalation was bound to become more problematic, if we're stuck in Europe, then we are entitled to something in exchange for that. It's like George Bundy, Kennedy's national security advisor, says, we have to pay the price of leadership. We may as well get some of the benefits. And what are the benefits? The benefits are the United States should call the shots for the Western Alliance as a whole. The Western Alliance had a policy on all of these issues that might well lead to a collision with the Soviets. For the time being, not terribly dangerous, but it will be dangerous after, or would be dangerous, after the Soviets acquire survivable forces and American nuclear superiority is a thing of the past. We got to worry about this stuff now. And since the West might be pursuing a policy that could lead to a collision with the USSR, right? We, since we're committed, we're involved, or we're stuck in Europe, we got to exercise control over the Western side of that process that could lead to a Third World War. So the Kennedy policy became much more active than Eisenhower. Eisenhower, he viewed himself as just kind of kind of a shepherd guiding this flock of unruly sheep, and he just wanted the European allies to kind of come together on a policy, and America would kind of try and mediate and so on. He wasn't directly involved in the shaping of Western policy to anything like the extent that Kennedy was. And Kennedy, it was, these people got to follow the American lead. I remember there was one document that I saw when I was working on this stuff at the Kennedy Library. And Kennedy himself, in his very short memorandum, he said, this is what we got to do in terms of working out some sort of political accommodation with the Soviets. As for our allies, they're going to have to either come along or fall behind. We're not going to be held back by these people. The way America had been held back during the Eisenhower period to a certain extent, right? Dramatic transformation, a transformation from America's policy toward Europe in the political sphere, and then you see it also in the military sphere. All these things that are being done in the military sphere, they had a common theme. The centralization of control, the centralization of power in the hands of the political authorities in Washington, right? And there are a whole bunch of acronyms, and I'll explain these acronyms. CQ, this is a term meaning command, control, and communications, right? Under Eisenhower, you didn't really have a strong system for making sure that nuclear weapons could not be used without direct authorization from the political leadership in Washington. And now they started really building this whole infrastructure to make sure that the commanders in the field could be in touch with the political leadership and receive instructions from them. Okay. PALs. The PALs, that means permissive action links. These are kind of locks that you put on these American nuclear weapons in Europe so that they couldn't be used without codes being released by the political authorities. This was to prevent unauthorized use. In other words, we were withdrawing from the system of de facto control over American nuclear weapons, which had been put in place during the late Eisenhower period. Right? SACEUR. That stands for Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. That's the NATO commander. In this period, his name was General Norstad. And Norstad was a product of the Eisenhower period, and he thought that SACEUR was a major figure in his own right because he had this pre-delegated authority to kind of use nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances. But now, SACEUR's, these are phrases from the day, his wings were clipped. No longer would he have this pre-delegated authority. That SACEUR was being racked back, this is from another document, to the role of an ordinary American field commander. In fact, this led to this whole big confrontation between Norstad and Kennedy in late 1961, in which Norstad refused to kind of go along with what the Kennedy people were doing in a bunch of areas. He says, I'm not just an American general. I represent the alliance as a whole. You can't dictate to me. And basically, they forced them out. They announced that, we're very sorry to note that General Norstad is resigning as SACEUR for reasons of health. Norstad says, well, there's nothing wrong with my health. He went back to Paris and told his French friends, look, I've been fired. And in fact, that was true. Very important. And all these things, of course, are being carefully noted by the European allies, especially by the French. MRBMs. These are medium-range ballistic missiles. These are land-based weapons that you could put on the territory of the European allies, including West Germany, capable of attacking the Soviet homeland. And now we're saying, no, we're not going to deploy these things. Again, the fear was that if you deployed MRBMs in German territory at time of crisis, the Germans would overwhelm the American custodians and seize control of these weapons themselves. We didn't want to come anywhere near that sort of thing. And instead, they came up with this plan for the MLF, Multilateral Force. The French called it the Multilateral Farce, with reason, by the way. The whole idea here was, the Europeans needed something in the nuclear area other than a flat American nuclear guarantee of protection. We'll create this kind of sea-based force, and manned by the Europeans on a multinational basis. You know, each ship would have Greeks and British and French and so on. And but the thing about the multilateral force, and the reason the French called it a farce, was that the use of these weapons would be subject to an American veto. So what was the MLF giving them other than just the kind of a sop? It was like a sham. You know, they weren't being given anything in terms of the ability to use nuclear weapons independently. British and French nuclear weapons, I talked about American policy, had changed in that regard. Now we're opposed to helping these countries develop a nuclear capability. And nuclear doctrine, all this flexible response stuff, especially at the nuclear level, the whole idea that if war broke out, it would be fought in a way that spared the enemy's cities so that the enemy would have a very strong incentive in a retaliatory strike to avoid attacking your own cities, and the war would be fought in this kind of protracted way, in a very controlled way, and so on. As I said before, this didn't correspond to what was really being done on the operational level. So you have to say, well, why did they adopt a rhetoric that was not... did not correspond to what they were actually doing? Answer there is because they wanted to provide a rationale for saying no to the Europeans, saying no to the idea of independent forces, because the claim was independent forces were inconsistent with this whole new American strategic doctrine of controlled and protracted war. The Europeans could fire off their weapons at will, then the Americans would no longer be able to exercise centralized control, and this new theory rationalized that. Okay? So you have the Americans seizing control, and in particular the Americans opting for this policy of keeping the nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Germans. Why was this important? Because in principle, it opened the way for a political understanding between the United States and the Soviet Union. Right? Again, a non-nuclear Germany. We're going to keep Germany non-nuclear. We're going to stay in Europe for good. And so German power is going to be contained within the structure dominated by the United States, a country that had made it clear that he was willing to live with the status quo of a divided Europe. Kennedy lays this stuff out to Khrushchev at the Vienna summit in June of 1961. Right? He says, we understand your concerns about Germany. Yeah, we accept the fact that you're going to dominate Eastern Europe. Right? Key passages that were initially deleted from the record of this meeting when it was first released. Right? Okay. We're offering the Soviets, basically, everything that they could reasonably expect from us. But they don't accept the offer. Right? Instead, Khrushchev talks in terms of, a Third World War is imminent if the Americans don't cave completely. And the Kennedy reaction is, look, we're willing to give these people everything that they could reasonably ask for from us. We're willing to solve their number one security problem, control of German power. And look at their reaction. This is an outrage. So Kennedy goes back home, gives a very tough speech in July of 1961, saying the American people has to prepare itself for war. We have to build fallout shelters and so on. Soviets now, they're the ones who get frightened. Following month, they throw up the Berlin Wall. They seal off the border between East and West Berlin. Right? They're saying, well, isn't this throwing in the towel? If you're looking for something that could symbolize Soviet acceptance of divided Europe, divided Germany, divided Berlin, Soviet acceptance of the status quo in Berlin, you couldn't ask for anything better than a wall. Right? It meant that the Soviets had realized that they couldn't push things much further than they had, at least not for the time being. But the Americans don't see the Berlin Wall that way. We get real upset by it. And in fact, the Kennedy administration starts making it clear, indeed in public, that it's willing to move much further in terms of granting concessions to the Soviets, moving away from the standard Western position in a lot of different areas. All right? See? Soviet reaction to this? Let's accept the outstretched hand. Let's take this offer. No, exactly the opposite. The fact that the Americans are making these concessions, this is all evidence of weakness. You know, we've shaken the tree and look at what's fallen out. Let's give it some more shakes. Who knows what we can get? So this American attempt at reaching an accommodation with the Russians doesn't have the desired effect. And in fact, leads the Soviets to pursue a more intransigent policy. Okay, very important. That's the thrust of American policy vis-a-vis Russia. All of this stuff causes this big crisis in the Atlantic Alliance. The military stuff as well as the political. The military side, the whole notion that the Americans say, we're the ones that should have all the power in the alliance. You people shouldn't even be allowed to have nuclear weapons to defend yourselves. You know, even the British, who are least antagonistic to this stuff, are just appalled by the whole thrust of American policy. De Gaulle, the French leader, his feeling is... you know, we're at the hour of Munich. The Americans will never go to nuclear war for the sake of Europe. We have to put something else in place, and that something else would have to be based on a Franco-German understanding. So he sides with the Germans and their objections to what the Americans are doing, because the Americans are making all these concessions at Germany's expense, basically toward accepting East Germany, accepting the division of Germany. Big crisis in the alliance, especially between the United States and Germany. But our feeling is that if we can reach a deal with the Soviets, we could pretty much force the European allies into line. And it's the Soviets that don't accept this stuff. And so then what you have is the Americans make it clear what their terms are. The Soviets take all the concessions. They put them in the refrigerator, to use the phrase of U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk at that time. They take what we're willing to give, but they're not willing to give anything else in exchange. And the Kennedy attitude evolves in the course of 1962. The American plan, it's proposed in a document of March 62, important document called the Principles Document, laying out all these things. We're going to keep Germany non-nuclear. In exchange for that, we want you guys to accept the status quo in Europe, and in particular, the status quo in Berlin. Right. Soviets, no dice. And the Soviets make it clear that they intend to kind of resuscitate the Berlin issue, push the Berlin issue to a head again after the midterm elections in November of 1962. Kennedy senses that a crisis is coming. He knows also that the strategic balance is deteriorating for the United States. America still enjoys a measure of strategic superiority, but that's over by September of 1963. Kennedy is briefed to that effect. American strategic superiority is a thing of the past. War breaks out, no matter how hard we strike and how fast, the Soviets can go on and launch a counterstrike that would basically destroy American society. Nuclear escalation, out of the question. Okay? Kennedy's inference from this is, we can't just sit on our hands and allow the crisis to develop at a time when we've lost our nuclear edge. Better sooner than later. Preventive war mentality. We have a window of opportunity. Let's bring things to a head sooner rather than later. It's going to come anyway. Given that, we may as well have the confrontation at a time when we're in the best position. Right? This is Kennedy's thinking on the eve of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It in large measure explains why the Kennedy administration reacted way it did when it discovered that the Soviets were deploying missiles in Cuba. Above all, since the deployment of those missiles in Cuba was interpreted in the context of what was going to happen in Berlin. The Soviets were trying to get themselves in as good a position strategically to have a showdown with the Americans over Berlin. Given that that was the case, this whole Cuban episode is an integral part of the Berlin crisis. And taking a tough line in Cuba was our way of bringing the confrontation with the Soviets to a head at a time when we could still prevail, when American strategic superiority was still meaningful. Okay, that's the background of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Climax of this whole Berlin affair. Okay, the United States basically gets the Soviets to back down in October of 1962. The entire political equation totally transformed. Okay. And the way it was transformed paves the way for a political settlement. Soviet policy, the Khrushchev policy, revealed as bankrupt. American policy still want to stabilize the peace along the lines of the plan that Kennedy had been pursuing since 1961. American policy doesn't change. And it's in that context that a whole set of arrangements falls into place in 1963 that provides the basis for a relatively stable political system, the Cold War political system, which, as I say, provides the basis for a relatively stable international order for the balance of the Cold War period. So that's what I'll be talking about next time, the 1963 system.